From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Forty years ago tomorrow, a brigade of CIA-trained Cuban exiles invaded Cuba. On today's Fresh Air, a look back at the Bay of Pigs. We talk with Peter Kornbluh of the National Security Archive about recently declassified CIA and Cuban documents which reveal new information about the invasion. And we'll listen back to a telephone conversation about the invasion between President Kennedy and his brother Robert. Also, we hear from two individuals involved in the effort, Alfredo Duran, who was part of the brigade that invaded Cuba, and Robert Reynolds, the CIA's Miami station chief at the time of the invasion. The 40th anniversary of the Bay of Pigs coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Syria has put its troops in Lebanon on high alert after Israeli warplanes destroyed a Syrian radar site. The Israeli attack killed three Syrian soldiers and wounded six others. Israel said the attack was in retaliation for the death of an Israeli soldier killed Saturday by Hezbollah guerrillas on the border between Israel and Lebanon. Israel accuses Syria and Iran of financing and supporting Hezbollah's activities. Meanwhile, today, Palestinians allegedly fired mortar shells at an Israeli town, and Israel struck back. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports from Jerusalem.
Israeli security sources say Palestinians fired at least five mortars into an Israeli city. They landed in a field in Sderot, some 3 miles outside the Gaza Strip, the deepest penetration into Israel proper so far. The desert town is not far from the ranch of Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon. Within a few hours, Israel responded with more helicopter missile strikes. The army hit Palestinian security headquarters in central Gaza near a refugee camp. In an unusual move, the Palestinian Authority issued a statement insisting it is not responsible for the mortars, as Israel claims. Jordan's foreign minister made an official visit to Israel Monday in an effort to ease tensions, but Israel dismissed his proposals, reportedly objecting to a call to resume negotiations on a final peace deal. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Jerusalem.
The West African nation of Benin is appealing for help in locating a ship believed to be carrying as many as 200 children who were to be sold as slaves. The ship left Benin 10 days ago, but it was turned away from Gabon and Cameroon after authorities learned of the child cargo. UNICEF, the UN Children's Fund, has set up a receiving center in Benin's capital to care for the children if they're returned. Jury selection began today in the murder trial of a man accused of bombing a Birmingham, Alabama church during the civil rights struggle of the 1960s. NPR's Debbie Elliott reports.
A 12-person jury will be selected to hear the charges against 62-year-old Thomas Blanton, Jr. The former Klansman is accused of murder and arson in the 1963 bombing of Birmingham's 16th Street Baptist Church. A dynamite blast during Sunday morning services killed four black girls. Prosecutors and defense attorneys will choose the jury from a pool of 100 people, about half black and half white. They filled out questionnaires today and will be called back later in the week for questioning. Once the panel is selected, testimony will begin next week. The jury will be sequestered for the duration of the trial. It's expected to last about 2.5 weeks. Debbie Elliott, NPR News, Birmingham.
In stocks today, the Dow gained 32 points to close at 10,158 in light trading. The Nasdaq lost 52 points to close at 1909. This is NPR News. Cincinnati's mayor has lifted a citywide curfew imposed after several days of violence and vandalism that accompanied protests over the police shooting of an unarmed black teenager. Mayor Charles Lucan said he left a state of emergency in place as a safety precaution. Lucan promised reforms that would make the city police more accountable. The mayor wants to appoint a commission that could recommend reforms and then supervise their implementation. That would require the approval of the city council, which meets tomorrow. A new champion has shaken the dominance of Kenyan runners in the men's division of the Boston Marathon. Alex Ashlock reports from member station WBUR.
Korean Lee Bong-ju crossed the finish line in 2 hours, 9 minutes, and 43 seconds. He cracked a string of 10 consecutive wins by Kenyan men. Speaking through an interpreter, he said he was proud to be the first Korean winner of the Boston Marathon since 1950.
He's very, very happy. happy, and it's a big honor for him because last winners were like his heroes.
American Rod DeHaven was sixth in the race, the best finish by an American man since 1994. A Kenyan woman did win the title today. Catherine Deriba defended her crown from last year. And in the wheelchair races, Ernst van Dijk of South Africa and Louise Sauvage of Australia were the winners. For NPR News, I'm Alex Ashlock in Boston.
The countdown has begun for this week's planned launch of the space shuttle Endeavour. The shuttle is scheduled to lift off Thursday afternoon. It will deliver and install a nearly 58-foot robotic arm on the International Space Station, a job expected to require two spacewalks. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for National Public Radio comes from NPR stations and the Amundsen Foundation for support of the NPR Endowment, helping to ensure NPR's financial future.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Tomorrow marks the 40th anniversary of the Bay of Pigs invasion. It was the event President Kennedy called the worst experience of his life. It still resonates in the hostile relations between the U.S. and Cuba. Shortly after the Cuban Revolution, which brought Fidel Castro to power, the CIA trained and commanded a brigade of 1,400 Cuban exiles, mostly living in Florida. On April 17, 1961, the brigade landed at the Bay of Pigs and invaded Cuba. They were defeated within 3 days by the Cuban military. My guest Peter Kornbluh was one of the organizers of a 40th anniversary conference that brought together Cubans and Americans in Cuba last month. Kornbluh also successfully filed to declassify American and Cuban secret documents about the invasion. He's an analyst with the National Security Archive. Joining Kornbluh is Fernando Ramirez, chief of the Cuban Interest Section in the U.S. That's the position that would be the Cuban ambassador if the U.S. recognized Cuba. I asked Peter Kornbluh what the American government wanted to accomplish by invading Cuba.
The Kennedy administration was set on rolling back the Cuban Revolution. The Eisenhower administration had authorized this operation. It started as a smaller infiltration program meant to drop cadres of guerrilla fighters into Cuba and then supply them so they could organize an uprising against Fidel Castro's government. And it evolved between March of 1960 from a $4.4 million smaller covert operation into a massive $46 million paramilitary assault of the island. And the CIA, drawing on a kind of arrogant imperial mentality towards Cuba, simply thought that by landing 1,500 brigade members on the beach of the Bay of Pigs, the Cuban population would rise up against Fidel Castro and overthrow him. And they turned out to be extraordinarily wrong.
What are some of the things that went wrong that made the Bay of Pigs invasion such a failure for the Americans?
Well, quite a few things went wrong. In fact, the Bay of Pigs has been called the perfect failure because so much of its objective, every element of its objectives failed, and all the mechanics failed as well. The first thing that went wrong is that despite U.S. CIA attempts to bomb and destroy Castro's small air force, several planes survived, and the Castro military was able to quickly deploy those planes the morning of the invasion, and sink almost within the first 3 or 4 hours of the invasion. Two ships, one of which was carried the ammunition and the fuel. For the invading force. Once those ships were sunk, it was very unlikely that the brigade members could hold out, could be resupplied, could have enough fuel and ammunition to keep fighting. But the main thing that went wrong for the United States was that the Cuban military came and fought. And the intelligence reports and the reports to the president during the battle are rather extraordinary, in saying, you know, the enemy has proven much more forceful and dynamic than we ever could have imagined. The Cuban government, to its credit, decided to actually declassify a number of documents. It was the first official declassification of Cuban documents. A special stamp was even created in Cuba, declasificado, you know, for these documents. And I think that was important. I'm hoping that the this conference and the dissemination and study of these new Cuban documents is a model for the future, that Cuba will go ahead and release other documents, particularly from the 60s, relating to the Cuban Missile Crisis, the 40th anniversary of which is coming up next year, and other episodes of key importance in U.S.-Cuban relations.
Peter Kornbluh, what are some of the things you learned from these declassified Cuban documents?
We learned the caliber and breadth of Cuban intelligence efforts against this operation. Cuba did have some spies, if you will, in Central America, contacts within Guatemala, and certainly people in Washington and in Florida sending back information on the preparation for this invasion force. Some of the information that got sent back was incorrect, and some of it was correct. These documents illuminated Cuba's ability to know what was happening and to prepare itself for the invasion, even if, as we were told at the conference, there was no Cuban spies actually in the camps themselves, certainly no Cuban spies in the Kennedy administration, and that Cuba did not actually know the date or the location of the invasion force.
Did the declassified Cuban documents reveal anything about the Cuban-Soviet relationship at the time of the invasion?
Cuba did not, at this point, declassify any documents on its relations with the Soviet Union, which, as Fernando Ramirez can comment, was not as an advanced as a relationship as after the invasion. One of the ironies of the invasion and counterproductive nature of it is, of course, it helped push Cuba into the Soviet orbit in terms of gaining diplomatic, political, and military support from the Soviet Union to counter the aggression of the United States. Let me just say there was one very interesting document that the U.S. delegation brought, a document discovered in the British archives by a colleague of mine, historian James Hirschberg, which showed that the CIA director, Alan Dulles, had sat down with the British authorities in late 1959 and said, please don't sell advanced fighter aircraft to Cuba. If you don't sell these weapons to Cuba, then they will be forced to go to the Soviet Union to buy them. And now I'm quoting, then we will be able to do something, unquote. And this was an extraordinary document that kind of showed the Machiavellian approach of the CIA to try and create a propaganda peg to overthrow the Cuban government by pushing it into the Soviet orbit.
When Dulles, the head of the CIA, said, then we will be able to do something, he meant that if the Cubans were more deeply into the Soviet camp, there'd be an official, legit U.S. reason to intervene in Cuba.
He tells the British that that in the case of Guatemala, where the CIA had covertly intervened to overthrow the government in 1954, they'd used as a justification the fact that the Arbenz government had purchased arms from Czechoslovakia. And in fact, it was the same thing. The CIA had blocked Arbenz's ability to buy any arms from the West. And I have to say, at the conference, conference, Fidel Castro spoke to this issue of purchasing Soviet arms and said that initially the Cubans had not really wanted to have arms from the Eastern Bloc, but when it became apparent that they would need to defend themselves, they went ahead and got them.
Fernando Ramirez, do you think that the Cubans strengthened their alliance with the Soviets as a result of the Bay of Pigs?
That was one of the results, without any doubt, because we didn't have any choice, because as Peter's said before, the first weapons that we tried to buy to defend Cuba at that time, what we thought was the Batista people who were plotting here in the United States against Cuba, we tried to buy from the Western European countries. In the case of England, United Kingdom, the response was what Peter explained. In the case of France, they sold us some weapons, like in the case of Belgium. But that was our original approach, because really what we really want to defend, at the beginning, we want to defend Cuba from the Batista people that unfortunately received support from the United States. And for that reason, because the invasion, because what everything happened after that, we didn't have any other choice to really to receive the weapons and to receive the military assistance from the former Soviet Union.
Peter Kornbluh, what have recently released documents from the United States shown about the relationship between the CIA and the Kennedy administration on the Bay of Pigs invasion?
There are many, many documents about the relations between the Kennedy White House and the CIA leadership, particularly the architect of the invasion, Richard Bissell. And it is clear from the documents and from his memoirs that Bissell and other CIA officials were simply not fully candid with the President of the United States. The declassification of the CIA's own internal after-action report on the Bay of Pigs invasion makes it clear that the CIA leadership grossly misled the President on whether this operation really had any possibility of success.
Now, my understanding of some of the newly released American documents is that some of these documents show that the CIA never really believed or didn't fully believe that this invasion was going to succeed in overthrowing the Castro government. What the CIA was hoping was that it would provide that some of the Cubans would be inspired to work against Castro, and that this invasion would also cause the kind of turmoil that would provide an excuse for the United States to intervene in a more overt way.
Bissell had an assassination track going against Fidel Castro. He had authorized the CIA in August of 1960, as the invasion force was being created, to work with the mafia to create poison pills for mafia contacts inside Cuba to try and slip into Castro's food. These pills were passed in March of 1961, only weeks before the invasion into Cuba, in hopes that Castro would be assassinated and that chaos would ensue, and that this would help the invasion actually succeed. The idea here was to land a force on the beach, have them hold this area for 3 or 4 days, fly in a provisional government of exile leaders, and have the United States recognize this small group that the CIA had hand-selected as the new government of Cuba, and supply them with open military support to continue the fight militarily to overthrow the Cuban government.
My guests are Peter Kornbluh of the National Security Archive and Fernando Ramirez, chief of the Cuban Interest Section in the U.S. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Peter Kornbluh, one of the organizers of last month's Bay of Pigs 40th Anniversary Conference in Cuba, and Fernando Ramirez, chief of the Cuban Interest Section in the U.S. Peter Kornbluh, on the National Security Archive website, you have a couple of excerpts of phone conversations between President Kennedy and his brother Bobby Kennedy, who was the Attorney General at the time of these conversations. And these are conversations about the Bay of Pigs invasion, but these are conversations that were recorded 2 years later. We're going to play an excerpt of the first conversation on this website. Peter, would you give us the context for this conversation? Tell us what's happening here.
During the battle at the Bay of Pigs, which lasted a little short of 3 days, the president did authorize U.S. Military aircraft from the destroyer Essex to fly air cover for planes from the invading force to help the battle advance. And the planes flown for the brigade force were actually flown by American pilots who were working with the CIA and the Cuban exile brigade members in Nicaragua. One of the extraordinary debacles of the invasion militarily was that these planes arrived from Nicaragua and the air cover arrived too late. There was a time zone change. There was an altitude difference, and they missed each other, and there was no U.S. military air cover. And two of these planes were shot down, and four American pilots killed. And 2 years after the invasion, even though John Kennedy had maintained publicly that there were no American personnel involved in this invasion, the Senate was sniffing around and was learning the truth about this, and that prompted a call between the president and his brother to try and deal with how they were going to continue to cover up the fact that Americans were involved. One of the interesting things about the Bay of Pigs invasion is that the very first person on the beach was a CIA official named Grayston Lynch, and he got off the boat and put a lighted beacon on the beach so that the rest of the small boats would know where to land in the darkness. It was a fiction at the time that the United States was not directly involved with support, training, and actual personnel in leading this invasion force.
The United States was trying to make it seem like it was just Cuban exiles who were
exactly.
going in there on their own volition.
That's right. The cover story was that, you know, so-called freedom fighters from Miami and Central America, Cuban exiles, had organized themselves, trained themselves, armed themselves, and were now invading Cuba to save their homeland from communism. But the truth was that this was a U.S. Initiated, organized, supplied, and led operation.
Well, let's hear that phone call between John Kennedy and Bobby Kennedy, recorded in 1963, 2 years after the Bay of Pigs invasion.
We're just talking about the fact that in an interrogation last week of the Senate committee, Senator Goldwater asked some questions about the use of the carrier aircraft from the carrier Essex,
yeah,
with their markings painted out.
Which, yeah.
Well, we figure that somebody over there has told them about, you know, that thing on Wednesday morning.
Yeah,
and that therefore it's either Dirksen's going to spring it or Goldwater's going to spring it, and they're going to try to spring it in such a way that it looks like there was U.S. air cover and that you were wrong and I was wrong in saying there wasn't. Now, the question is, what exactly is it we're going to get Max Taylor to look up exactly, or are you familiar with what happened on that?
Did we paint out the marking?
Yeah,
the plane? You
painted out the markings of the plane.
How many planes?
And I think there were 3 planes.
Yeah.
And they flew air cover for an hour.
Yeah, but didn't see anybody.
Over the beach.
Yeah.
And they were supposed to give air cover to the B-26s that were coming in.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, between all of them, they got the hours mixed up. I think you gave them from 7 to 8 or something.
Yeah.
And they must have thought it was 7, CIA thought it was 7 to 8 Central American time.
Yeah.
So the result was that the B-26s came in an hour late and were all shot down.
Yeah.
Two of them shot down.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably the ones that have been murdered.
Yeah.
I think that has been in the paper about the fact that they threw this air cover for an hour.
Is that been in the paper?
I've seen references to it in the paper. I don't know if any formal story has been written on it, but it's been in the paper that they, and it's been in U.S. News and World Report,
yeah,
that they specifically, I'm almost sure, I've read it someplace.
Oh,
in the last couple of months,
yeah,
about the fact that they flew for that hour.
My guess is it's going to come out. You're just trying to figure out how to get it out. If we can say it's been all printed, otherwise Dirksen will announce that the United States plane with a painting marked out flew over the Bay of Pigs and were only used an hour, and therefore either you were wrong or I was wrong and not using them more, and so on and so forth. So we're trying to think about how to.
Well, I think if somebody could look up where it's appeared in the newspapers. We've had that kind of people over there.
Yeah, I would think that's a rather difficult assignment.
Not really.
It's an excerpt of a conversation recorded in 1963 between President Kennedy and his brother, Bobby Kennedy, who was the Attorney General at the time. And you can find a longer version of this on the National Security Archive website. Peter Cornblue, it's just kind of amazing that the people organizing this didn't know about the time zone change, and that really screwed up the whole invasion.
I think there were several key factors, but this was one of a long line of problems in the military deployment of this invasion. I can tell you from looking at the broader history, and certainly from the history that came out of this conference held in Havana just several weeks ago, that it would have made no difference if the air cover had been there or not. That on the ground,
mm-hmm.
the correlation of forces was extraordinarily weighted towards the side of Castro's military, and they were there fighting hard. As Dean Acheson, the former Secretary of State, said to John Kennedy after the invasion failed. It doesn't take Price Waterhouse to tell you that 1,500 Cuban exiles aren't as strong as 25,000 Cuban military soldiers.
Now, I believe some of the documents that the Cuban government released for this Bay of Pigs 40th anniversary conference were transcriptions of phone calls and walkie-talkie conversations by Fidel Castro during the Cuban counterattack against the invading force. And Castro was leading the Cuban army against the invasion. Fernando Ramirez, what are some of the revelations, do you think, in these transcriptions of the Cuban of Castro's commanding conversations?
Well, first place, Terry, the fact that Fidel by himself directed all the operations on the ground. That was something that I think that is very important. All the offensive, all the military operation in detail was directed by him. And second, they were very colorful, and really he know how to command all of them, and in a way that really all the forces move forward, and they have very clear instructions to try to defeat as soon as possible the military invasion, and in that way to defeat the military plan from the United States against Cuba.
When you say they were colorful, do you mean that he cursed a lot?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
And let me just say, Terry, in its infinite wisdom, the CIA picked a spot at the Bay of Pigs that was the area of Cuba that Fidel Castro was most familiar with. He had spent tremendous amount of time there, fishing, vacationing, working, knew the area, all the roads, all the beaches, almost like the back of his hand. And that enabled him to be really a hands-on, immediate military commander. And I think from the transcripts, a rather effective one.
Yes, but on the other hand, Peter, from military point of view, the location was very good, considering that the military goal was to establish a beachhead just for a few days and then to ask the U.S. intervention, because Terry was a very isolated area, very poor, by the way, with a very scarce population. There were swamps all over. The trees that in from the west, from Havana, from Matanzas, they just was just one highway, the only way to reach the beach. And for that point of view, for the military purpose, it was very well designed.
Peter Kornbluh is an analyst with the National Security Archive. Fernando Ramirez is chief of the Cuban Interest Section in the U.S. I'm Terry Gross. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, promoting excellence in journalism worldwide and investing in the vitality of 26 U.S. communities. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our look at the Bay of Pigs with Alfredo Duran. He was a member of the brigade of Cuban exiles that invaded Cuba under the leadership of the CIA. And we hear from Robert Reynolds, the CIA's Miami station chief at the time of the invasion.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. 40 years ago tomorrow, my guest Alfredo Duran invaded Cuba as a member of the Brigade of Cuban Exiles under the leadership of the CIA. The brigade was defeated by Cuban forces within 3 days. Duran was one of the more than 1,000 exiles taken prisoner by the Cubans. After his release, he returned to Florida, where he now practices law. He's the former chairman of Florida's Democratic Party and past president of the Brigade's Veterans Association. Also with us is Robert Reynolds. He was the CIA station chief in Miami at the time of the invasion. Both Reynolds and Duran attended the Bay of Pigs 40th anniversary conference in Cuba last month. I asked them each to describe a high point of the conference. Here's Alfredo Duran.
At one point, I was just finished explaining on the board where the battle plan was, the actions that the brigade was taking at a little town called San Blas, when we had been under artillery fire for 48 hours. And after I finished our battle explanation, the artillery officer who was commanding the batteries against us came up to the board to explain their position. And there have been many, many people who had died at that battle during the past 48 hours. And as he approached me, we looked at each other in the eyes, and we instinctively shook hands. That was a very intense moment. Most of the people at the audience stood up and applauded, and I felt that at that very moment, the ice had broken in the relationship that had existed up until that point between the brigade members and the colonels and generals who had fought against us. I think that it dissipated a great deal of tension, and from that moment on, the whole convention took a different type of atmosphere, at least between the Cuban participants and the brigade members. And I thought that it became all of a sudden more relaxed, more open, and we started, to some extent, trusting each other more.
Bob Reynolds, as the CIA station chief in Miami at the time of the Bay of Pigs invasion, what was a high point for you of the recent Bay of Pigs anniversary conference?
Well, I think I'd start with the same incident that Alfredo just described. Watching the first reconciliatory gesture by the representatives of the two sides was a very emotional experience. Apart from that, I'd like to say that meeting Fidel Castro was quite an experience for me. As I made the point in the conference itself, for 4 years that man dominated my life. I started following his progress through the Sierra Maestra in 1957 and stayed pretty close to Cuban affairs right up through the Bay of Pigs until sometime late in 61. So coming face to face with a man, having several verbal exchanges with him, shaking hands, being his guest at lunch, and later at this sumptuous farewell dinner, was quite an experience for me.
If you don't mind my asking a very forward question, were you in on plans to try and assassinate Fidel Castro?
Not at all, and thanks for asking. I was, I'm grateful to say that I was far away from any of that.
What was your role in the Bay of Pigs invasion?
It was extremely marginal. We in Miami were responsible for recruiting in large measure the people like Alfredo who formed the brigade. Once we recruited them, we flew them down to training camps in Central America, and that was the end of our responsibility. From that point on, they were under the control or management of other people.
Bob Reynolds, when you and your men were recruiting Cuban exiles living in Miami, recruiting them to join this invading force, what were you telling them about what to expect of the invasion?
At the very beginning, when we began recruiting people, we didn't really have yet a plan for the invasion. We were just pulling together a force and getting it trained as planning progressed. Originally, as I recall, we had in mind a much smaller force, not a brigade, but maybe a couple of hundred people who would actually sort of do a Castro. They would become a guerrilla force in the mountains. We'd drop them in some way and keep them resupplied and let them work their way up the up the island the same way Fidel did. That concept, though, was replaced by the one of a larger body and an invasion force. But at the beginning, we didn't tell anybody anything very specific about what was going to happen with them because we didn't really have a firm plan.
Alfredo Duran, when you were recruited by the CIA to join this brigade that was going to invade Cuba, did you know that the CIA was trying to make it seem as if they had nothing to do with this, that the Cuban exiles in Miami were on their own organizing this invading force? That's how the CIA wanted to make it seem. Were you aware of that?
Yeah, I was. I was really not recruited. I enlisted. I sought out the recruitment offices and I joined. But I knew that everyone knew that the CIA was behind it. It was Miami in those years was almost like Casablanca. Everybody was talking invasion, revolution, guerrilla, terrorism, everything else. Miami was quite an active place, so everybody knew what was going on. What I enlisted for was I believed that we were going to be trained as a guerrilla force to be dropped in the mountainous areas of Cuba, and from there on take the fight on our own. The whole invasion plan developed later on, which made it much more complicated from the point of view of the United States, because an invasion required a tremendous other amount of logistics and supplies. But at any event, I knew that the CIA was behind it. I knew that the CIA did not want it to be known that they were behind it. But I also knew that everybody knew that the CIA was behind it.
When you enlisted, how did you know where to go to enlist? Did you know CIA agents?
Well, everybody in Miami in those days knew where the recruitment offices were, and every person was sitting in the corner. There actually was a recruitment office open where you would go, enlist, you would be given some sort of medical and taking measurements, and it's pretty much like recruiting for the Army.
Why did you want to return to Cuba and fight against Castro?
Well, you have to understand that we were living right in the middle of the Cold War. We had just been learning about the Stalinist crime in the Soviet Union. Many of us were young, idealistic Cubans who did not want our country to turn into a communist dictatorship. We believed that that would be very tragic for the country, and we decided that it was something that we had to do. We had to come in and try to save the republic. And many of the people in the brigade, the brigade, you have to understand also, it's like a rainbow of Cuban political thinking and society of that time. A lot of the people, for many reasons, including many of them, came out of the Catholic universities and stuff. And we really believed that we didn't want communism in Cuba. And therefore, we were taking on a crusade. As a matter of fact, the emblem that we chose to represent the brigade was a cross surrounded by a Cuban flag. So we believed at that time that we were in a crusade to bring Cuba out of what would become a tragic future, which would be a communist dictatorship.
Tell me more about what you expected to happen after you got to Cuba as a member of this invading force. What did you think the outcome was going to be?
Well, the outcome was everything that I did not predict that it would be. First of all, I thought that we would win or I could die. I never expected to lose and live. I thought that if we would lose, we'd be shot. So the outcome was completely surprise to me. The other thing that was a surprise, and some of these things I learned at the conference in Havana a few weeks back, is that the plan that was developed, which was called Plan Pluto, really from the very first day was not adhered to. It was a plan which we were supposed to land at the Bay of Pigs, which was supposed to have guaranteed some success for a few days at least until other things happen. But that plan itself was not ever developed to its full capacity. The bombing was stopped on the 15th of April. It did not occur again, which was supposed to take out Cuban Air Force. We did not have access to supplies. We did not have access to have a air cover, which was very much needed. We could not really advance without air cover and under enemy bombardment. And so that was a surprise, which you could detect from the very first day that the plan was not working. The reason we detected that from the very first day is that indeed the Castro Air Force was bombarding us around the clock. They sank the supply ships, and they virtually pinned us down to a point where we could not advance. And after the third day, of course, we ran out of supplies and ammunition, and we could not continue to fight. So we had to basically start our withdrawal and ultimately go into the swamps. So it was the failure of the plan from its from the very beginning was very obvious to the people the very day that we landed on the beach.
Did you feel betrayed that some of the things that you were promised by the CIA never materialized, like air cover?
Well, I personally didn't feel betrayed. I was a big boy. I knew what I was doing. I knew what I was going to do there. I was hoping for support, but if we didn't get it anyway, I feel committed to the battle. And therefore, I don't feel betrayed. At that point, I was thankful that we had an opportunity to do this. I never felt that I was acting in the interest of the United States foreign policy. I never felt that I was acting as a mercenary for the CIA. I never felt that I was doing any other thing than fighting for the future of my country. So I didn't feel betrayed.
Alfredo Duran, were you paid by the American government? And if so, how much?
When I recruited, I really wasn't expected to be paid. I think that they paid a stipend to our family. I think that my wife got about $200 or something a month in support of my wife and my minor and my son who was born, as a matter of fact, while I was in jail.
Alfredo Duran, when you were fighting in Cuba as part of the force of Cuban exiles, did you recognize any of the Cuban soldiers you were fighting against? I imagine when you left Cuba that you left behind friends and possibly even family. And maybe some of those friends and family were in the Cuban military fighting against you.
Well, during the battle itself, no, I did not recognize them. But, you know, after we were captured, many of them came over to where we were. And obviously, I saw and I met with some who had been my friends from my youth. And it was very emotional. And as a matter of fact, one of the other brigadistas that was in this conference with us, Mr. Mario Cabello, two blood cousins were fighting against him, and his father was on the other side also. So it was this whole process of the Bay of Pigs, and that's why it's so intense for the members who participated. And I don't know if Bob was able to feel that what was happening there between us is that it was very much like a civil war. We were fighting families. And obviously, there's a lot of passion and a lot of tension and a lot of sorrow because we were, everyone who died in the Bay of Pigs on whichever side had a relative or a friend or somebody close on the other side. So the suffering was mutual, no matter who won or who lost.
Alfredo Duran, you spent, I think, 18 months in a Cuban prison after the failed invasion?
That's correct.
What were the prison conditions like?
To tell you the truth, you know, it was harsh, but we were never mistreated. It was we were overcrowded, we were underfed, we were under cared for as far as medical and medicine care, but we were never mistreated. They did the best to take care of us. Our conditions were not the best in the world, but at least we felt that we were being treated with respect. They gave us the condition of prisoners of war immediately, and maybe that had helped along to have a type of condition within the jail itself, which was more respectful and with more regards to our needs.
My guests are Alfredo Duran, a member of the Brigade of Cuban Exiles that invaded Cuba, and Robert Reynolds, the CIA's Miami Station Chief at the time of the Bay of Pigs invasion. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Alfredo Duran. He was a member of the CIA-led brigade of Cuban exiles that invaded Cuba 40 years ago, and Robert Reynolds, the CIA's Miami station chief at the time of the invasion. I want to ask you each another question about the Bay of Pigs anniversary conference in Cuba, which you both just attended. Because of this conference and because of the anniversary, both Cuba and the United States released a number of previously classified documents. I'm wondering if you can each mention something that you learned from these declassified documents that changes the picture of what really happened for you. Can we start with Barb Reynolds, who was the CIA chief in Miami at the time of the invasion?
Yeah, I brought with me a book of declassified documents in case you asked. I think perhaps the most interesting for me was this long memorandum that Vice President Nixon wrote after a long, long interview, meeting he had, I think 3.5 hours with Fidel Castro. Very perceptive and full of insights and understanding of the man, of Fidel. And probably the milestone marking the beginning of deterioration of our relations with the Castro government. It's, I think, April 1959. And Nixon writes, "My own appraisal of him as a man is somewhat mixed. One fact we can be sure of is that he has those indefinable qualities which make him a leader of men. Whatever we may think of him, he is going to be a great factor in the development of Cuba and very possibly in Latin American affairs generally. He seems to be sincere. He is either incredibly naive about communism or is under communist discipline. My guess is the former." So here's an assessment of Castro by our vice president at the time, which turned out to be pretty accurate.
How did that compare to your assessment of Castro when you were Miami bureau chief for the CIA?
Well, this was written before I went to Miami. I was still in Washington, but I, as one who followed Castro's progress through the guerrilla phase, I was very pro-Castro in those days. He was opposing a dictator, a corrupt regime, and as I put it at the conference, like most Americans, I was all for someone who was brave and dedicated to the mission of eradicating this bad regime and replacing it with his own. So, up until the time that he took power, I was I described myself as a Fidelista, and the people I worked with on Caribbean matters, I think we all felt that way.
Wait a minute. It's hard for me to absorb this. CIA guys being pro-Fidel?
I know. This raised some eyebrows at the conference, too. But I'm talking now about the period of time when he was working his way through the mountains in a guerrilla campaign aimed at toppling Batista.
Mm-hmm. So what turned you around into the anti-Fidel camp?
Things were edging from about the time of this interview with Nixon. Things were starting to sour. I don't recall all the details, but there were lots of nationalization of private property. There were overtures to the Soviet side. There was a visit by Mikoyan, and I'm sure I'm wrong. I don't have all the dates in front of me. But there was a general harshness developing in the tone of Fidel and his administration toward the United States, and things were worsening to the point where a year after his ascension to power, we had broken relations with him.
Alfredo Duran, did you also respect Castro when he was in the mountains and leading the revolutionary force? Did you think he would be a good leader, and did you want him to overthrow Batista?
No, I did not. Not at that time. I was one of those few Cubans that was never Fidelista. I belonged to a family that was politically allied with the Batista government, and therefore I had not good feelings towards the Cuban Revolution at that time. In essence, I was against the Castro government before he got into power, and maybe that's one of the things that motivated me also to join the Bay of Pigs, other than my ideals regarding the future of Cuba.
My guests are Alfredo Duran, a member of the Brigade of Cuban Exiles that invaded Cuba, and Robert Reynolds, the CIA's Miami station chief at the time of the invasion. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Alfredo Duran, a member of the CIA-led Brigade of Cuban Exiles that invaded Cuba 40 years ago, and Robert Reynolds, the CIA's Miami station chief at the time of the invasion. Alfredo Duran, as someone who fought in the Bay of Pigs invasion, what would you most like to know that you don't know yet about what really happened behind the scenes?
You know, one of the questions that I did not get a chance to ask because the conference took on a long time, and as Bob, I'm sure, remembers, every time that Fidel Castro intervened, it took several hours of intervention.
he talks a lot.
Sure. But I didn't get, when we were at that stage, I didn't get to ask what the thought process was to come to the political decision to how to handle the brigade by the Cuban government. Why did he not put us against the wall and shoot us? Why didn't he throw us in jail for 30 years as we were sentenced to? And why did he decide us to trade us for $62 million in food and medicine? That thought process I would have very much enjoyed to understand, because it sort of defined what the views of Castro as to his political future were and how to deal with his relationship for what happens to be the next 40 years vis-a-vis the United States. The Bay of Pigs was a very defining moment in history of Cuba. It defined for the next 40 years the relationship with the United States. It defined the political and social divisions of Cubans among ourselves for the next 40 years. And basically, it defined also to a great deal international relationships in Latin America, and almost created also a nuclear holocaust on the missile crisis. So it was a very important factor, and the aspects of the political thought process to me was of great interest, and I didn't get a chance to really get into that.
And Bob Reynolds, what would you most like to know about what happened behind the scenes during the Bay of Pigs invasion?
I would love to know to what extent our forces might have rallied dissident parts of the populace of Cuba.
And that was part of the official intention, was to...
Yes, we had rosy hopes that the brigade would, with its initial successes, would attract other volunteers who would join. Am I right about that, Alfredo?
Yeah, that's correct. There was expected to be an uprising.
And I don't think we'll ever know. I do know that Castro's secret police had done a pretty good job of rolling up small groups of resistance people that we had tried to establish elsewhere on the island that were not related to the invasion. But the life expectancy of such resistance groups turned out to be rather short. So the big question in my mind is, would we have been able to rally behind us, by we I mean the brigade, support from the populace? And I say we'll never know.
Alfredo Duran, you are the former chairman of the Florida Democratic Party. And I'm wondering how much continuing impact the Bay of Pigs invasion has on Florida politics today.
It has had a great deal. The Cuban-American Republicans, as part of their recruiting efforts, always bring out the Bay of Pigs, and they call it the treason at Playa Girón. And that has been a powerful motivating factor to the point that I think that the Cuban Americans are the only Hispanic group in the United States that are overwhelmingly Republicans. You have here a registration of probably 75% or 80% Cuban Americans Republicans, and that is almost inversed in every other Hispanic group in the country. But it is a very powerful motivating factor, and many Cuban Americans believe that the failure of the Bay of Pigs basically condemned the Cuban nation to be under the Castro government for the past 40 years.
I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Pleasure.
Thank you very much. Bob, nice talking to you again.
Good talking to you, Alfredo.
Alfredo Duran was part of the CIA-led Brigade of Cuban Exiles that invaded Cuba. Robert Reynolds was the CIA's Miami station chief at the time of the invasion. Tomorrow marks the 40th anniversary of the Bay of Pigs invasion. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Monique Nazareth, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet, with Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Howe, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Saab, with safety features including the active head restraint, front and side airbags, and OnStar, all standard equipment. Information available at saabusa.com. And from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Wendy Swallow discusses her new memoir about her divorce. She found that the conventional wisdom was not only outdated, but was just wrong. For instance, married people seemed to envy her as much as pity her, and it wasn't true that her children would be happy if she was happy. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.